Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to open my our Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. And I know that Senator Roblin is going to come in and introduce his bill, but until he comes, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 491.
Madam Chair, while the people are coming up, I just wanted to just let the social workers who are here know that as a social worker, I'm here in solidarity with you, but I've got to go pick up my daughter shortly from school. But I wanted to at least pop in and welcome you to the committee. I'm going to have to get going shortly. I also wanted to let you know, Madam Chair, if it's your pleasure, if this 491 passes out today, I'd be happy to carry it on the floor if you'd like me to as a social worker who has some experience in such matters.
Thank you. And this is Larry Connor and Wendy Curtis. Please introduce yourself.
Chair Montes Anderson, my name is Larry Connor. I'm a licensed professional counselor, and I'm speaking today as the president of COPACT, the Coalition of Oregon Associations for Counseling and Therapy, which represents licensed professional counselors, LPCs, and licensed marriage and family therapists, LMFTs, across Oregon. We're here to testify in support of Senate Bill 491, which allows licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage and family therapists to provide mental health services to adolescent clients on the same basis as other licensed practitioners. Licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage and family therapists have been licensed to practice in Oregon statute since 1991. LPCs and LMFTs are highly trained, master's-level mental health providers who offer psychotherapy services to individuals of all ages, families, couples, groups, and organizations throughout Oregon. Currently, there are 3,500 LPCs and LMFTs and registered interns in the state, and we estimate that each week they work with over 70,000 Oregonians seeking services in mental health clinics, private practices, hospitals, prisons, educational institutions, and rehabilitation agencies. Current statute allows a teen age 14 or older to consent to outpatient mental health or chemical dependency treatment services. Under current statute, a physician, a psychologist, a nurse practitioner, or a licensed clinical social worker are all authorized to provide those services to consenting teens. Senate Bill 491 would simply add licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage and family therapists to current law. Teens seek help for a variety of issues such as drug or alcohol abuse, depression or anxiety, or suicidal behavior. Some teens desperately in need of help face challenges in getting that help. Sadly, some parents are emotionally or sexually abusive or neglectful, or they face problems of their own, such as alcoholism or drug dependence. Or, following a divorce, the conflict between parents can leave teens caught between a custodial and a non-custodial parent. All of these can create barriers for their teens seeking help or seeking permission to get help. As my colleague Wendy Curtis will explain, with statistics about suicide risk for teens in Oregon, the result of losing the opportunity for a teen to get help is potentially tragic. Senate Bill 491 creates parity between all providers of mental health services, which helps ensure that an LPC or LMFT is not forced to turn away a teen in crisis. In addition to our commitment to serve Oregon teens in need of mental health care, we are concerned about how current statute could complicate the implementation of health care reform in Oregon. Current statute could inhibit LPCs and LMFTs from contracting with continuing care organizations or accountable care organizations due to a lack of parity with other providers under the law. Senate Bill 491 levels the playing field between all licensed mental health providers in Oregon. So creating this parity will help ensure the broadest network of providers is available to the new health care organizations and will support access to care throughout Oregon, which is especially important in rural and underserved portions of the state. Senate Bill 491 does not change any other provision in current law. The exemptions for community mental health agencies and the liability protections for covered providers remain the same. Senate Bill 491 is good for Oregon families and teens. By creating parity among mental health care providers, it helps ensure access to mental health services and it supports effective treatment for troubled teens. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. We ask your support for Senate Bill 491, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Let's go ahead and have Wendy Curtis, and then we'll open up.
Chair Monis, Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Curtis, and I'm a licensed professional counselor in private practice. I'm also on the board of COPACT, and I'm here today to provide testimony in support of Senate Bill 491. Prior to having my own private practice, I worked at a mental health agency for 4 years as a youth addictions counselor. I saw adolescents ages 13 through 18, along with their families, for issues such as substance abuse and dependence, mood disorders, including depression, anxiety, and other mental health issues that many adolescents struggle with. Over my 4 years at a community mental health agency where teens 14 years of age or older can consent to their own treatment and or in some cases were in a dependency proceeding, I saw hundreds of clients, over half of whom came from families that did not include both biological parents married to one another. The youth I saw often came from families experiencing some type of turmoil, including such things as divorce, separation, abandonment by a parent, neglect, addiction, instability, and more. A portion of the population I served, children who did not have good relationships with their parents and whose parents were often a barrier to the client accessing services, sometimes did not get the help they needed or there was a significant delay. Unfortunately, in a number of cases, my teen clients struggling with addiction were being enabled in their addiction by their own parents' substance use. I also saw many teens in crisis that did not feel safe talking to their parents. Sometimes this was warranted. Other times it was out of misplaced fear. But the opportunity to form a therapeutic alliance with the teen client and to help unpack what made them afraid to tell their parents allowed me to build trust and then a proper intervention in the cases where the client needed help coming out of isolation and engaging with their family, which we were able to make happen over time. Senate Bill 491 simply allows me to have parity among other licensed mental health care providers and helps to ensure access to mental health services for adolescents who are struggling. We know suicide is the leading cause of death among Oregonians aged 10 to 24. In 2007, nearly 1 in 12 8th graders and 1 in 16 11th graders reported they had attempted suicide in the past 12 months. It is of the utmost importance that we make sure teens have full access to quality mental health care. I ask for your support for Senate Bill 491. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. The bill is an easy one. You're the only two to testify, and it's just adding a very well-known, well-established profession to the list of a physician, a nurse practitioner, a clinical social worker, a psychologist. So unfortunately, I don't have a quorum right now. So if I do get a quorum by the end of the day, we will probably pass the bill out. So thank you very much. I certainly don't have any questions. Do you? All right.
Thank you.
With that, I would close the public hearing on Senate Bill 491. And can he?
Arnie's right out there.
Yeah, and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 608. And we're waiting for the Senator Roblin, who's just right outside.
And you'll probably have to, when Chip gets back in, just bang out, right. Bang back in.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 608 is at the request of Senator Roblin. The bill is requiring Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt form and standards for enrollees to claim reimbursement of out-of-network provider charges paid by the enrollee. It requires the insurer within 30 days of receipt to pay that claim for the covered services made by the enrollee on the form, on the DCBS form. This declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay. Evidently, Senator Roblin is not out there, so.
But we have a quorum.
I apologize. I was.
So I will. Should I close?
Yeah.
Temporarily closed.
Yeah, I'll temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 608. And I want to open a work session on Senate Bill 491.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 491 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 491 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Okay. And just to bring you up to date, Senator Steiner Hayward, licensed professional
yes.
counselors and
I
therapists.
Remember,
you
I
do
remember this one well, and I completely support it.
All right.
There you go.
Any further discussion?
Yet.
Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hewitt?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
Excused.
Senator Shields?
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Ronson?
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Shields will carry this bill. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 491 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 608. Senator Roebland?
He looks familiar.
Yes. At least I got to stay in the same conference room. You had to move. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Arnie Roebland, Senate District 5, Senator. This bill is one that's been a few years in the making, actually. You're going to get to hear in a few minutes from my dermatologist, who had worked at a clinic, and at the time I was seeing her. Since the fine work she's done, I haven't had to go back, so it's been nice. But she made a professional decision that she wanted to have a clinic that really was all about the medicine that she practices and made accessible to lots of different people. And you're going to hear from her today, I think, about the fact that what she's doing now really avails her services to a wide variety of patients because it is much less expensive to get her treatment. At the beginning, she has had a number of issues with respect to getting payments from insurance companies. She has tried to comply with their wishes by coding it in different ways and giving her patients the receipt and information that they can then go file for themselves. She doesn't go about filing it for them. And each time they think they have something worked out, we end up with a situation where her patients who have insurance, and many do not, the result is that the insurance denies it for one reason or another. And what we're asking is that that we as a state look at this and look at the practice that she's doing and understand what she's doing and say there needs to be a way for those people who have insurance, who have paid for those things, can get reimbursed at a rate equal to an out of policy provider, at least. I think if they really could understand what was going on, it's to their benefit, and I know it's to the patient's benefits because I know a lot of her patients, including myself, are very satisfied with the work she does and the effort she puts in as being a professional and a doctor in our area. And as you listen to all the evidence, I hope you consider this bill and the way it's been put together as one way to encourage less cost for medical care in Oregon. And I stand ready to answer any questions you might have.
Not at the moment.
Okay.
And I'll let you get back to your committee, and we will temporarily close the public hearing.
Thank you.
On Senate Bill 608 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 356. Sandy?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 356 is at the request of Senator Monroe and Representative Tomei. This specifies requirements and a code of ethics for navigators for the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange, otherwise known as Cover Oregon, requires the exchange corporation to adopt rules to implement the requirements.
So let's call up, she's neutral, okay. Susan Pease Bannett, David Sant, and Nancy Wilms. If Please proceed.
Okay. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, thank you for having us. My name is Susan Pease Bannett, for the record, and I'm a clinical social worker from Portland, Oregon. I also have a great deal of experience in medical social work. I trained in the Harvard Medical System, and I'm married to a physician as well. This is an issue that's near and dear to both the hearts of social workers and physicians. Senate Bill 356 specifies qualifications for the navigator role, or community partners, as some call it, in Oregon's health insurance exchange. This bill does two important things. First, it implements a code of ethics that would ensure that those in the navigator role have an understanding of how to assist Oregonians in challenging or unique health situations. Second, it clearly spells out the role of the navigators in relation to health insurance brokers and agents. As you know, one of the key parts to making this Oregon Health Exchange a success is how effective Oregon is at getting consumers to use this exchange. For many of the underserved and vulnerable populations, a navigator will be their first point of contact in helping them access the exchange. This bill is an attempt to help ensure that this important role is filled by people who are qualified and have the unique training necessary to be most effective and trusted. This bill was brought forward in part because there are no current definitions of navigators. This is an attempt to ensure that as the exchange starts to recruit these workers, they have the skill set needed to reach and help Oregon's diverse populations. Currently, there are very vague guidelines by the federal government, and in SB 99, the role of navigators is undefined, which opens up opportunities for unintended outcomes. This is an attempt to ensure that quality people are in this vital role and that the navigators are people you can trust to advise you on what's best for you and your family over a wide range of conditions and situations. This bill uses parts of the social worker's code ethics, which is already being taught in schools across the state. Nowhere in this bill does it say that you have to be a social worker to be a navigator. And I'd like to just add to that statement that social workers have a unique training among health professionals in that we are trained to look, we're generalists, and we look at the range of situations and backgrounds people come from. We're trained as systems interventionalists, and we're trained as mental health providers. In the medical social work world, we're also trained to be knowledgeable about all the issues regarding medical care and helping patients interface with that. I speak strongly for NASW and myself when I say that you have a great opportunity here to tap into a population that's already up to speed and ready to go in this role. And while we don't want to necessarily confine it to social workers, it's nice to know that you have a workforce that's sitting here ready and waiting for this opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Testimony.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Sant, and I am a licensed social worker who works primarily with people living with severe and persistent mental illness. Each person's story is unique, yet shares a strand of similarity with the rest. One client that I work with is a Muslim refugee diagnosed with schizophrenia. He is from a war-torn African nation. He speaks little English, and his family is separated by thousands of miles, and hence trust a select few. I've also met an African-American woman living with schizophrenia and insulin-dependent diabetes from the Albina district in Portland, whose family has experienced vitriolic racism. She continues to be distrustful of all entities that have power in her life. I've also experienced a son whose adoptive mother has to plan his burial because individuals living with severe and persistent mental illness often die 25 years earlier than those who are healthy. And this is just a subset of the populations that these navigators will need to be able to work with in the exchange. These navigators aren't just going to be talking with people who get on the exchange. It is my understanding that as people look for health care, these navigators will be working with Medicaid clients or people needing other resources. We today are advocating that navigators need to be unbiased, abide by a code of ethics, and have an educational background in helping people and families navigate life-altering choices. These navigators are going to have to interact with many different people with many different needs and must be sensitive to them. Having someone with a code of ethics is vital. When one is working from a code of ethics, they will be able to interact with diverse populations in the most effective way. As a social worker, I have learned that when we put clients first, we gain their trust, and most importantly, provide services that are relevant to their needs and unique situations. Having an understanding of populations who are living in crisis, whether economic, familial, or medical, is vital to creating lasting situations and solutions that positively impact those that we seek to serve. It is imperative that these navigators are sensitive to the ethnic and cultural diversity that surrounds the lives of the residents of this great state, whom we seek to enfranchise with this legislation. That is why I think the standards outlined in this legislation would be most helpful in making these navigators effective as they work to get people onto the exchange, and indeed, to all Oregonians who are looking for a helping hand. Thank you for your time.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nancy Wilms. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I work here in Salem at Willamette Valley Hospice as a medical social worker. And in my day-to-day work with families who are in these very vulnerable situations and these difficult times, it's very hard for them to make decisions regarding their own health care. And their ability to trust me and my colleagues, sometimes that's the only way that we're able to get things done. And one of the things that Senate Bill 356 does is to help ensure that Oregonians can trust the navigators as they help them make these crucial decisions. The bill helps prevent any appearance of conflicts of interest by stating that the navigators cannot receive any compensation from any insurance. We want to make sure that these navigators are looking out for the individual's best interest. And equally important is that the individual is able to trust the navigator to help them make the right decision at this very crucial time. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Comments? Questions? Not for now. Well, all right. Thank you very much, panel.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Laura Majeski and Megan Moyer. And let's have Laura go first.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Majeski, and I'm with PacWest Communications here on behalf of the Oregon chapter of the National Association of Social Workers, reiterating our support for Senate Bill 356. I provide a unique perspective in a sense that I have been watching the exchange development and implementation in both Oregon and Washington. In Washington, they are having the navigator conversation now. It has been a very transparent process throughout. They have subcommittees dedicated to each specific role. For example, there is a navigator technical advisory committee specifically dedicated to development, and they have been open to the public throughout. This is something that we have not seen here in Oregon. They also have a very unique structure with the navigator program. They're taking an umbrella approach. We'll be having lead navigator organizations who will then focus on one specific geographic area, who will then subcontract with specific community organizations, thus serving those at the local level. There have been discussions already around experience, outreach, resources, health literacy, cultural needs, and conflict of interest. Oregon's navigators. This is a critical component of the exchange that needs to be addressed. We are worried that the navigator role is being lost in the shuffle. Senate Bill 356 is an attempt to help ensure that this position is filled by people who are qualified and have the unique training necessary to be most effective and trusted. We are open to any suggestions on this bill that would help advance our overall goal. We've been in communication with Senator Steiner Hayward about this. And I would just conclude by saying that we want Cover Oregon to be successful. You know, Oregon continues to be recognized as a leader in the health reform effort, and the Navigators are a vital piece to Cover Oregon's success. Other states are moving forward, and now is the time to start this conversation to ensure Oregon's Navigators are effective in the long run. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm here with the Service Employee International Union, Local 503. We would like to first begin by saying that we strongly support efforts to create a very strong code of ethics in regards to the practice of navigators and the importance of addressing both real and perceived conflicts of interest. It's extremely important that the work of navigators be done to the highest ethical standards where the individuals they're working with is and their best interest is the sole concern. So we appreciate the emphasis of that in this legislation. And we do strongly support accountability for those who become navigators. We do have a few areas that we would like to see changes in the legislation. First is we do not think it's necessary or potentially in the best interest to put a job description in legislation. We do speak from personal experience, although the term navigator is new. We did use these community partners in the work of signing up children for healthy kids. SEIU participated as a community organization to do specific outreach to our own membership. We do represent over 20,000 very low-income members, many of whom had children who were uninsured. We did a very targeted project toward our own membership, getting their children signed up for Healthy Kids. We chose to have two of our staff members who had spent each over a decade in our member benefits department, took a leave from their job, and connected into the field with our organizers to work directly one-on-one with families in the process of signing up for Healthy Kids. That was an extremely successful project for us, and we would hate to see people with that kind of experience. One of the people who from our staff who chose to take on that project was bicultural and bilingual. We think that representation of people from diverse backgrounds is extremely important, not just the education or training someone receives, and we would hate to see diverse populations being discouraged from participating as navigators, so we'd love to see that area expanded. We also have concerns about a very education-focused, again, requirement instead of looking at cultural background, cultural competencies, experience as organizers in communities. I think there are a lot of important skill sets beyond training and education that would lead to an effective navigator. We also would like to see the removal of the mental health disclosure. We do not think it's appropriate for individuals to need to report when they seek treatment for addiction or mental health condition. It may be completely irrelevant to the work that they're doing, and we do not want to put anything in statute that discourages any individual from seeking needed care. We also have concerns around the reporting required if an individual is arrested. I think it's really important to preserve due process and question the relevancy of that requirement as well. We are very happy to participate in any kind of work group to make sure that as we develop the role of navigators, that it is done in a way that holds navigators to the highest ethical standards, but also reaches that goal of cultural diversity and effectiveness. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
So as Laura mentioned, she and I have had some conversations about this, and I would agree with some of your comments. I don't think we have any other code of ethics ensconced in statute, and I think it's probably more appropriate for that to be done in the context of the licensing board or the agency that's employing people, because things change. And when we enshrine something in statute, it can be very complicated to change if we don't get it right. The number of technical fix bills that we do boggles the mind. And so I would encourage us to take that out. We talked also about the mental health issue and why that might not be appropriate to have in here. I appreciate the concerns raised by your clients and raised by the people who testified. I didn't ask some of these questions to you all, not because I knew that Laura was going to be testifying, and she and I had had some of these conversations already. We absolutely do want these navigators to have the highest ethical standards, and we do want them to have the cultural competency. Certainly social workers are among the people who have these characteristics, but we also have people in the communities already, as you pointed out quite rightly, who have the skills and the cultural competency and the connections with the community that may make them very appropriate to serve in these roles. And I worry a little bit about firmly defining by a specific educational criterion or something like that. I think it has much more to do with competency than a specific education. I think it's very reasonable to consider encouraging the health authority to be very clear about their criteria for who's going to be doing this, and also to think about how they've done similar things in the past and figure out what's worked well in those circumstances and what hasn't. So I don't know whether this bill is the best vehicle to do it. I support the concept of making sure that the people who are doing these jobs do have the cultural competency, do have the connections to the communities. I'm just not convinced that this bill as it currently exists is the best vehicle for doing that. And you're welcome to comment about it, but this is the conversation we have. And I just wanted, since you referenced that conversation, I wanted to bring up what we talked about. I think I completely agree with the general principle. I'm just not sure that this is the best way for us to get to that principle.
Right. And Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, thank you very much for bringing that up. We are completely open to having this conversation, getting Cover Oregon involved and getting SEIU involved so that we can reach a compromise. You know, we just want to make sure that we reach that overall goal of getting the most qualified people in this role.
I remember in the legislation, and I forget what the bill number was, 99? Senate Bill 99. And we talked about this, and we talked about the role of navigators, and there were a variety. We didn't want to really exclude communities who maybe had, as I think you brought up, Megan, that are more versed in the cultural competency or cultural aspect of a community. We wanted to... We even talked about agents and brokers still, you know, being able to have a role as a navigator in a sense. I mean, there was a broad range. And I think, is David Barenberg here? Yeah. Why don't you come up? He's from Cover Oregon, and it's Cover Oregon that's setting up the process. And I know that they're going 100 miles an hour so that we can, but it would be nice to get information from him on what we are doing with the role of navigators right now.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, I'm David Barenberg, and I'm representing Cover Oregon, and thank you for the opportunity to appear today. And Cover Oregon clearly shares the values that have been expressed by all the speakers today. We are firmly committed to having a cadre of individuals and organizations that are committed at the highest ethical standards to bringing as many uninsured Oregonians and Oregonians who can qualify for health subsidies and others to health care. The model that we're using differs, I think, from the Navigator word or from the model that Washington is using. What Oregon is going to do is build on the successes that Megan had talked about with Healthy Kids. We have a program that has worked, that has signed up many kids and families, has an infrastructure in the community. The intention is for Cover Oregon to work with OHA to administer a community partner program, which will utilize community-based organizations to conduct outreach and enrollment assistance to individuals and families seeking Cover Oregon services. As part of this effort, OHA will sign agreements with grantees and volunteer organizations to conduct outreach and enrollment assistance. OHA will work with existing community partners to amend some of their agreements and retrain application assisters. Cover Oregon is going to have a program for training the application assisters, which is the term that we're using. It will involve an online component. It will involve an in-person component. It will involve an annual testing or certification. There will be conflict of interest standards for all of the agencies that are contracted with, which flow through to the application assisters, so that somebody who has a vested or financial interest will not be providing advice to the individuals who come through the system. Some of the types of organizations that have been contracted with by OHA have been in underserved communities. Some organizations like the Agent Health and Service Center, the Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization, the Native American Youth and Family Center. In addition to targeting these populations, we're looking at targeting underserved portions of the state and trying to build capacity for outreach to enroll citizens through the program. This is a major undertaking. We really want to build on the success rather than creating another model as how we approach this. And we will have in place conflict of interest standards. And we do look forward to working with the varied communities around the state. One thing that I do want to mention, too, is that in addition to contracting with agencies, what OHA has done and will build on is the ability to partner with other agencies in a voluntary method with health clinics, health providers, YMCAs, clinics, just to have a larger cadre of people which will be trained and certified by Cover Oregon. So we believe this is a critical part of trying to meet our mandate of serving citizens of Oregon, and we are working to try to get this program up and running so that we can enroll as many people as we can. Happy to take questions.
So you're saying that instead of using the word navigator, You have developed a process where the person is called an application
assistant,
and but could you see a social worker being able to fulfill that role also?
Madam Chair, we believe that social workers could be very qualified and could be among many who could provide those services. And, you know, as Megan described, Healthy Kids Outreach, just of a valiant effort of very committed and qualified social workers to do that. I mean, they're are going to be part of some of the organizations that we contract with, and there's an ability for folks to think of and apply for the grant funds that will be available. As well as, you know, some of the organizations that, you know, we mentioned that are likely to be interested in proceeding. So we welcome everyone to provide those assistance, but we don't want it to be limited to a particular set of qualifications. We believe that there are many people involved in community-based organizations that are directly working with some of the underserved populations that we can arm with new tools that they can use to serve the population that they're really already involved with.
We're coming up to October very fast. Do you have a job description now? Do you know when you're going to be hiring and training? Are you that far along yet?
Madam Chair, yes. We are in the process of working with OHA to finalize agreements and to develop an OHA to develop an RFP that will go out, I think, very shortly to solicit organizations to serve that role of community partner and then have the application assisters. So that is in motion and moving fairly quickly.
So you're saying you're an RFP, so the social workers as a unit would have to come to apply for that RFP?
Senator or Chair Mona Sanderson, the RFP will, you know, solicit the involvement of organizations that have a proven record and strategies for reaching different constituencies that will highlight, you know, some underserved minority populations, non-English speakers, immigrants. And, you know, within that framework, organizations will apply, and organizations may have, you know, social workers as their outreach workers or on their staff.
Okay. So the focus will be to be bringing
community or groups. Community.
What's the role of the insurance company in all this, then?
Chair Mona Sanderson, insurance agents will also be, you know, receive training from Cover Oregon, and they can work with clients to sign them up through an electronic portal for health insurance plans. So that's the assisters are not supposed to be are supposed to allow the individuals to make decisions and not direct the applicants to a particular plan or another. We're supposed to help them work through sorting and helping them, you know, to make a decision. The agents can make recommendations if people choose to use an agent.
Okay. But they will be required to go through the same training?
They're required to go through training.
Would they be applying for these grant monies? No.
Madam Chair, the grant money will only go to the application assisters who will have to have a conflict of interest requirement, so they can't have a vested interest in directing somebody or in the process. So they will be a neutral party that's trained to provide assistance, but not the direction to a particular plan.
Thank you. Senator Cruz.
Yeah. A couple of troubling things. The grant program, I mean, the Healthy Kids program was basically a bounty program, and we ended up in enticing people out of the private market into the public market, and I'm not sure that was necessarily in anybody's best interest, but that is what happened. The whole purpose behind the exchange is to be a marketplace for people to purchase insurance, and insurance agents are the key component of that. And by the way, they do have a code of ethics they have to live by. So what I'm hearing on this navigator stuff, it's almost bleeding over into the roles that the navigators will be playing in the CCO, not so much in the exchange. So I think we need to be very careful of the separation here.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, I think the model that we are working on is one to provide grants with targets and for the contractors to meet. I don't know that there is a cash payment envisioned per.
They're still in the parking lot down in Roseburg, a very fine-looking van with Healthy Kids on the side that somebody paid for.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, I can't speak to the existing OHA program. I can speak to what we're envisioning. And I think we're trying to keep, say that there are, everyone's welcome to the party to try to enroll as many people as we can. We see that there's a role for agents, and agents will be accessible from our website, you know, at the point where people need more detailed advice. It's a resource that we want to work with and call upon and see a major role for in the process, as we do with the application assisters in the organizations. We think that there's an awful lot of people to serve, and we're going to need to use all the tools to reach them.
Yeah, I guess, Madam Chair, and at some point in time, hopefully the offerings inside the exchange are more robust than I think what is available now, and those will be further discussions. to navigate into there to make the determination of what is the best plan for an individual. I think you need more than a degree in social work. You need to understand insurance to be able to do that.
How much federal money is helping us with the formation of what you're calling application assistance? Is there money coming from the Fed?
Chair Monis Anderson, yes, from the federal grant that we received. I think in the initial round of grants that there is going to be $2.9 million of money coming from Cover Oregon, which flows through from the federal grant we received.
How many employees does Cover Oregon have right now?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Cruz, I don't know at the moment how many. I know that there was federal grant money that would support far more than I think Cover Oregon's trying to be conservative in its hiring, given that eventually we will be funded through the, a charge. So we want to minimize the number of employees. I think that Cover Oregon was looking to be staffed up, not including the call center, at under 100.
Yeah,
and the call center is
now at this point or something ballpark.
Last time I sort of counted on an organizational chart was quite a while ago, and it was like 56. I'm happy to get you the real number, which I think is higher and changes daily.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
So the $2.9 million, can it be used for salaries for these application assistants, or is it for administration?
Senator or Chair Monis Anderson, that's the money that would go to the organizations applying, who would be saying, we're going to be providing the service of reaching out to these communities and trying to reach out to X number, and to do that, it will support, staff and what have you within those organizations. This is the amount of money that would be available for grants.
Okay.
And
will there be accountability? I mean.
Yes. Chairman Onis Anderson, I think there is going to be very clear reporting on people signed up, contacts. There's a whole set of performance measures being designed. And I know that Cover Oregon's director, Rocky King, is very hands-on in terms of wanting accountability and wanting it in fairly short and real time. So that will be one of the components.
Thank you. Further questions? All right. Thank you very much. There's no one else on the queue. All right. Because it's so different, I'm not sure if the proponents of the bill would want to work with the SEIU and Cover Oregon, but it is very, from what Cover Oregon has told us, it's very different than the model that's in this bill. Any other comments? All right, it'll be up to you to work with him. All right, with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 356 and reopen a public hearing on Senate Bill 608. Kathleen Brown, Jack Brown, and Gary Weeks.
Good afternoon. Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathleen Brown, and I'm a dermatologist practicing in Coos Bay, Oregon. And I appreciate the kind introduction by Senator Roblin and his sponsorship of our bill. Can you all hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. So just to briefly recap my practice, I opened in July of 2011, and I've been in practice since 1993. I'm double boarded in dermatology and internal medicine, and I've been with a good group, for over 13 years. So I designed my practice really to be my dream practice, specifically to remove the obstacles in the way of practicing high-quality medicine and to be accessible and patient-centered, to have a very novel thing, price transparency, price honesty, reasonable prices, and to practice high quality. And so in doing that, I removed a lot of the, I guess you call it, bureaucracy that is so rampant in the practice of medicine, all the layers and layers of things, and just work directly for patients. And so I don't contract with any third-party payers. I just work for patients. If it works for them, they can come to see me, and we're quite busy. So I think some people would think that my practice might cater to wealthy patients, and in fact, the very opposite is true. What we found out is that my practice caters to people who care about price. So I have people being referred from 2.5 hours away to have large tumors removed because we are by far the most affordable. So I'm very honored to have those people travel that distance. And the other population that works very well is the high deductible patients. And we're seeing among people who have so-called good insurance, their deductibles climb up and up and up. And I do a lot of surgeries in my facility, in my office, no outpatient surgery fees, so we're way more affordable. So that's my niche. A little bit about our bill. The purpose of our proposed legislation is to permit patients who see a physician like me who bills by time or procedure to file a claim with their insurance company simply using the billing statement instead of all the procedure codes. And the reason we do that is because this practice is designed to be simple and straightforward and for patients to be involved in price decisions. Do I need this doctor? How much does this cost? And so we took all of that out. And so I wanted to say the procedure code. Well, first of all, for anybody who's not seen, this is the current CPT book. And this is ICD-9, soon to become ICD-10, with about 10 times as many codes. And I just purchased the two of these this year's books, for $172 from the American Medical Association. American Medical Association owns CPT codes. It is a monopoly. They have an income stream from that. So, in practice, I wanted to say that the requirement for the procedure codes has been used by insurance companies to kind of entice people like me to go back in and contract with them, even though our prices are very much lower. So I have actually been threatened. And, you know, I said, well, where is that in your contract? Where is that in the law? Well, it turns out in the medical board rules, administrative rules, there's a little line in there that requires procedure codes, and what that means is these AMA CPT codes. So I think it's anti-competitive. I think it is hidden price fixing. I think it is wrong. If you're contracted with insurance company, then you need to abide by their rules and use the codes. If you're not contracted with them, if you work for the patient, then you work for the patient. And so I don't think that the insurance company should have a power over how you bill. So, in addition, I just wanted to say another thing about the use of these codes. Anybody in medicine knows that they're subject to gaming. It's part of the way medicine is practiced, very sadly. And it creates a conflict of interest. And so when there is a conflict which exists, it is the duty of the doctor, the practitioner, to put the patient first. And I think when there's so much power held by the third-party payer, it puts the doctor in a very, very difficult position. I am out of that. I work solely for my patients. But that is a problem with these codes, and I think everybody who practices medicine knows that. So I also wanted to say the American Medical Association represents well under 20% of practicing physicians. They have an income stream, so does Oregon Medical Association, that is based on the CPT code, so I don't think that they are unbiased on this issue. And Then if we look at my handouts there, I have some graphs, and I think they're a very nice illustration of the type of prices that we've been able to achieve. And so I'm not really quite sure why insurance companies object so much when the prices are so much lower. So we're really here to advocate for our well-insured patients who have difficulty getting reimbursed. And by my seeing those well-insured patients, extra work is put back in that I have removed. I didn't want all that bureaucracy, and it's put back in there, and it is not medical care. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Gary Weeks. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 608, in support of Dr. Brown's proposal. I have known some of you for many years in my 31 years of state government. I am still in the reforming bureaucrat program, so there's hope, I think, for me. But I appreciate a chance to be here again more as a citizen in support of this program that Dr. Brown is bringing forward here. I became involved in this at the request of a former representative, Ken Meserle, a year ago, when he approached me and said, you were the insurance commissioner once. I have a physician in my area who is struggling with the payment of her bills, her patient's bills, I should say, and can you help in some way? And so I began to talk to Dr. Brown and became familiar with the way that she bills, and then sat down in several meetings with the insurance division, many of whom I still know personally, and talked with them about the fact that, in my memory, insurance contracts actually didn't require a CPT code to be reimbursed. So in other words, I'm an insurer, I have an insured, and I have a contract with my insurance company. I don't think it requires a CPT code for you to reimburse me for legitimate services and treatments and procedures that are covered by my policy. And in fact, that's pretty much the case. Now, that's easy to change because you can rewrite the contract to require CPT codes. But in the spring of last year, in the early summer, we actually thought we had this program, this problem solved by working with the insurance division and with the companies, and more of them, the major companies, actually began to pay claims from Dr. Brown's patients based on her billing strategy. That turned out to change over the next few months, and now she continues to struggle to have her patients' bills reimbursed. And so these are bills submitted by insured patients for legitimate covered services that simply aren't being paid because they don't include CPT codes. So the next step, and certainly wasn't the first for us, was to try to think about changing the law and permitting or requiring, if you will, the reimbursement to a patient of legitimate covered services based on a description of those services and the time that it took to provide those services. And so that's what this bill does. The CPT codes, for those of you that don't know, the current procedural terminology codes are an AMA product. We're not here to criticize them. This bill is not about attacking CPT codes, although I found it interesting when I went up online. One of the first things I saw on a CPT code is the opportunity for me to pay $399 and buy a physician coder that I can put on my desk that actually eliminates errors, decreases denials from insurance companies, and gives me the convenience of getting my specialty codes that are most used in my billing process and stuff. So, but that's not the purpose behind this bill. The purpose behind this bill is to give a physician like Dr. Brown, who wants to provide a bill to the patient that describes the treatment and the procedure that the patient received and the amount of time it took, and then that bill would be reimbursed by the insurer. It's pretty straightforward. So it's really adding an alternative here to the requirement that many insurance companies have taken that you must provide a CPT code in order to be reimbursed. Under this bill, there would be an alternative to that. You could present the bill the way that Dr. Brown does or use the CPT codes. Now, is this going to take a lot more work from the insurance company? You need to understand that insurers, when they get a bill with CPT codes on them, don't just pay that bill. they look to determine, did the CPT code relate to the service that was provided? Is the code right? Is the code, you know, the correct one for the service provided? I mean, there is an examination of this. They're not just paid based on whatever the doc submits as the CPT code. So you've got to understand there's a lot of work that goes on at the insurance company already. And ironically, and I've, because patients have agreed to let me see this information, as Dr. Brown has, you look at the bills that she presents for considerable services, services over multiple days, and they're thousands of dollars less than would have been charged had she used a CPT code. So the insurers actually save money on virtually all the bills that come from her office over the cost had she been reporting all the CPT codes. So I'm not sure there's an argument about additional work on the part of the insurers. And then the other question that comes up is, well, will doctors now flock to this new method of billing? The likelihood is not. I mean, most physicians that are in physician groups or hospital groups or so on, they've developed systems that are based on CPT coding. They're not going to give up on those systems. You know, they're probably happy that they're in place and they have experts that are assisting them to get the right code, to take the most advantages out of the code. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's just the way you manage the codes. So the likelihood that there are going to be a large number of doctors wanting to do this is probably fairly low, but there can be and probably will be a number of physicians that practice like Dr. Brown does, smaller practices, rural areas. They don't want to spend a lot of time on the administrivia of putting in the right CPT code in order for their patients to get billed. So we think it's a reasonable option to have in the statute. We don't think it damages the credibility of the billing process in any way. And I guess in summary, we'd urge you to give this favorable consideration. It's a good idea. And I think both Dr. Brown and I are happy to answer questions.
Were you given a reason why the insurers weren't reimbursing you?
They don't speak to non-contracted doctors, so they don't tell you why.
Madam Chair, I think there still is an argument that under the current insurance code and the contract language, I think there's still an argument that this may not be possible, really, for insurers to deny this, but that's something the insurance division would have to spend some time on, I think.
And have you worked with the insurance division on this particular bill?
Madam Chair, we did. As I said, I met many times in the last year with the insurance division over how to deal with this problem without legislation, without having to, mm-hmm. to go to legislation. We thought we had it solved at one point and didn't. And then subsequently, when a decision was made where Dr. Brown wanted to pursue legislation, we've included the insurance division all along in the discussion about the bill, how it would read, what it would say, and so on.
Thank you. Questions? Go ahead and have a seat. I'll bring the opposition up.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
Well, we may have some questions for you. Tom Holt and Mike Dewey.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Dr. Brown has a system that may work very, very well for the cash-paying patient in simplifying things for them. But for those who are under insurance, it does not save money. It greatly complicates matters because claims from someone who is not only out of network but declines to participate in a well-established, well-vetted coding system imposes a lot of cost in processing that claim. Those codes tell us, usually through an automated process, exactly what was done for a patient, so therefore we know what to pay for it. When we get a request like one from Dr. Brown's office or from one of our members who has chosen to go there, it requires us to request substantiating information to know what was done, and that there's a cost to that that's very substantial. We do require use of the codes for coverage, and this is not at all unusual. In fact, in the four states in which Regents operates with our Oregon plan, we also operate in Washington, Idaho, and Utah. Dr. Brown is the only physician out of the thousands that we deal with who insists on imposing this cost on not just us, but on our members who ultimately pay this cost. There is also an issue here of complying with the Affordable Care Act's requirements for data reporting. I had to take you just for a minute into the weeds of something that's going to happen under the ACA. There's going to be what we refer to as the three R's of adjusting for risk in the new market come 2014. We will be required, as all carriers will be required, to report basically our claims data to the state and federal government. If we don't have complete coding information, which in this situation described we would not have, those instances of care cannot be taken into account in that mechanism. And the people ultimately served by this new system are patients who have high cost conditions. So that's a micro group that would be affected by this. We are concerned that this bill would open the door to other physicians declining to participate in the mainstream system. It is not true that we have a human looking at every claim to see what the CPT code says versus what that code ought to be for. The vast majority of our claims process automatically so that we can pay them promptly. Now, we do audit use methods to identify sort of outliers and do that kind of spot checking. But we couldn't possibly do a manual process like Mr. Weeks described without having dramatically higher costs than what we have today. We have submitted to, through Sandy, a letter from the Oregon Medical Association on this subject that was given to Dr. Brown several months ago, I believe, after Dr. Brown went before the Oregon Medical Board and appealed to the Medical Association to involve itself. And their answer essentially was that the coding is really an essential part of the system. And I just want to quote from part of this, and this is what the Medical Board had to say. They said, the use of procedure codes are an important part of practice, and the board does not want to change the rule to allow practitioners to use codes or a narrative description of the procedure. Instead, both will continue to be required. The board considers such procedure codes to be necessary as a standardized way to document procedures. We applaud Dr. Brown's effort to find a simplified way to serve patients, but she's made the choice to not contract with insurers, and we think it is not fair to impose the costs of her unique way of doing things on other members who we serve, who are paying, ultimately will pay that cost in order for her to participate in an insurance plan. She's welcome to contract with us if she's willing to contract in a way that, you know, all other providers do in providing the information that we need to accurately account for the procedures. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. For the record, Mike Dewey representing the ODS companies. I agree with what Mr. Holt said. We applaud Dr. Brown in terms of a model to find a process to lower healthcare costs. That's what we're here to try and do in this body. Unfortunately, the process she wants on the insurance side doesn't do that on the insurance claim. Now, in my tenure in representing ODS, I've worked with all of the parties on the uniform claim form. We've been through that. The proper codage usage for the forms, what constitutes a clean form so we can get this paid as quickly as possible, and then prompt payment. So we've worked through that, and today we have a very good process in Oregon, uniform codes for all the carriers, and that allows us to adjudicate as quickly as possible for our members and for everybody to get paid as quickly as possible. What this bill wants to do is provide for a narrative. And quite frankly, then we have the department describe what this narrative is going to be, and we have no clue what constitutes a narrative. It could be very broad in terms of the services I provide. Then you're going to have, quite frankly, unless you start a new coding system, you're going to have individual claims processors have to look at that. That's going to cost more time. The statute is 743911 that speaks to the clean claim, and that's why we believe the codes have to be on the particular form. So that's why there would need to be a law change under the clean form claim. Let me say last, for the practice of anesthesia, they bill by the hour, but they use the codes when they get reimbursed. So we also have the precedent here. With regard to the OMA letter that you have, the solution may be to go to the American Board of Dermatology to have that conversation and then perhaps come back to see if there's some sort of accord that can be reached within that particular practice. So this isn't, in our mind, ready for prime time by any means. It's something that would confuse the system. Thank you for your time.
The greatest frustration I have is she is able to deliver healthcare costs or healthcare services at a much lower cost. And we have developed a system that is costing the healthcare costs are out of sight, astronomical. And I feel that we're in this maze of complexity where more and more money is being spent on non-service-oriented, on non-service. And so
we don't disagree. It is an expensive system. That's why we have CCOs trying that experiment, the ACA. But I don't think this is going to get you to.
Well, I'd like to call Brian Bollinger from the Oregon Medical Association up here to talk about CPT codes.
Thank you for your time.
And we might as well have the insurance division up here, too.
Thanks. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian Beringer with the Oregon Medical Association. I had not planned to testify today, but needed to set the record straight on a couple things. First, the discussion of the letter. There was an appeal by one of our members made to our Healthcare Finance Committee, and we had declined to participate in part because of where the Oregon Medical Board had come down on the use of CPT codes. Didn't realize that was going to be part of the hearing today, or else I would have come with more information on that, and I can go get that for you if you'd like. But the other thing I wanted to make sure was very clear on the letter or on the record, the AMA is involved with the CPT codes and has a process around that. The OMA does not. So I think that was mentioned and possibly inadvertently, but we do not. So
it is the AMA that sets the pricing?
Correct.
And is it the same across the United States?
Well, the AMA has a process and a board that sets the CPT codes and the different versions of the book, and it is the same for everybody based on which version they're using. But I am, again, it's not OMA, and so I don't want to get too far into the...
I know, but just it seems to me that, you know, a procedure probably costs a whole lot more on the East Coast than it does here. I don't know. Or maybe it costs more here, and yet the same price through the insurance division is being paid.
Madam Chair, you're dragging me out of my comfort zone. There are different factors involved in that, depending upon who the payer is for geographic adjustment and other adjustments. Again, I'm not our expert on that. I could get that person here if you want to go into more detail.
That's all right.
Trust me, you don't.
All right. Jeanette?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jeanette Holman from the Insurance Division. As you know, we don't take positions on legislation without the governor's blessing. We have worked extensively with Dr. Brown and Gary Weeks on this legislation, trying to get it into a form that we can live with, that we think we could work with to come up with a solution. We did work with the carriers early on, and as Mr. Weeks said, we thought we had this resolved without the need for legislation. But it's my understanding, and I was not involved in those early sessions, but that around the first of the year, the carriers did quit paying for this again. I don't know if this is a factor, but you probably are familiar with the administrative streamlining.
Pardon us. Just a minute. We'll see who's calling us.
No, it's on the floor.
There you go.
Last session, we passed the administrative streamlining requirements where the Oregon Health Authority developed the companion guides, and we were directed to adopt those by rule for insurers to use in claims payment and different aspects of their transactions with providers. Those kicked in full-time across the board in January, and that may have had something to do with the insurers not paying any longer. Those do tie into the CPT codes. The solution in this bill is to develop an exception or another way for, and again, it's the enrollee, the patient who submits the form, and it's only for out-of-network providers, so it's not a form that's going to come in or that would come in, you know, frequently. I don't know how different the examination is when an out-of-network provider provides a service for an insured anyway. I don't know if they look at it more closely. That's a question for the carriers. But that's the approach this bill takes, is an exception or another alternative for when the enrollee themselves submit the form as opposed to the provider.
But the carrier is still saying...
Right now, the carriers are not...
CPT code.
Yes.
But this would develop a process where you would not need a CPT code?
If you're an enrollee, if you're the patient that's submitting the form, and it would, again, it would still provide some uniformity for that form that a patient would have to present, but it wouldn't require the CPT codes necessarily.
Further questions?
Well, I thought you said you had to comply with what the health authority did, and they have CPT codes, right?
The health authority develops the what are referred to as the companion guides, which right. are the electronic transaction right. guidelines. We adopt them by rule for the insurers to use with their providers. This would be...
I mean, did our legislation compel you to do that?
Or yes.
That's what I thought.
Yes.
Okay.
But this would amend that statute to allow us to adopt this alternative form as an alternative in those instances where a patient submitted an out-of-network reimbursement.
Do you think that providers would leave, become out-of-network, and is there a possibility to game the system?
Chair Monis Anderson, now you're putting me outside of mine. I always wanted to be a doctor, not a lawyer, but I went the alternate route. I don't know. I suspect that in most cases they probably wouldn't because they're all set up. But again, that's a question for the provider community.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I could just say one general comment. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate the innovation offered. And we do need to figure out ways to encourage innovation. I have a colleague in North Carolina, Dr. Brian Forrest, who's a family physician. And Dr. Forrest has developed a similar but different model for primary care, and I would commend his website and his work to anybody's attention because I do think it represents a really interesting model. And he has, in fact, now partnered with several insurance companies because he's been able to demonstrate in the context of primary care that he's actually improved health outcomes. It's a little different when you're talking about continuity of primary care patients and stuff like that than when you're talking about a subspecialist doing more procedural work and things like that. We're going to need to have ongoing conversations whether this is the right way to affect the change to help those innovations. I'm not so confident that we're quite there yet, but I do want to commend you for your innovation, and I do want to encourage everybody to start thinking creatively about how we can encourage similar kinds of innovation as we think about ways to control health care costs, reduce paperwork, decrease administrative burdens, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's not a question for anybody, but it is a comment to acknowledge the work that's being done and also acknowledge the concerns of those who are opposing this bill currently. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'd like to ask Tom Holt and Mike Dewey to come back up. I have a question then. If DCBS does adopt a form and standard for an enrollee to claim reimbursement, and it's out of, you know, as an out-of-network provider charges that were paid, why couldn't the insurer accept that letter, because there probably aren't going to be that many, accept that letter and reimburse them?
Senator Monis Anderson, for the record again, Tom Holt with Regents. The issue here is the manual processing that it creates, which adds cost. This isn't just some a low-level person looking at it, because we have to verify. If we're not given a code, it's still going to mean that we're going to have to discern what the narrative means. That's going to require one of our medical professionals to be involved. So this will be a cost shift, not a cost savings.
But
that's what we object
to. DCBS would be developing a form that I would think you would be able to tell exactly what service was delivered and the cost. And
Senator, we have probably spent more than a rational amount of time as a carrier trying to accommodate Dr. Brown, because we don't want our members to be caught in the middle of her very different way of doing things. But it just goes against everything we've done over a number of years to take administrative cost out of the system by automating claims processing. You know, we really try to reserve the manual handling of claims to those things that are highly complex and that are outliers that really require a medical professional or a case manager to be looking at. The costs add up really rapidly as we start having to deal with a manual claim. So no, it would not be helpful for the insurance division to develop a paper form to handle these types of claims. Dr. Brown, we, in our view, if she wants to use this method, and she's elected not to contract with any carriers, probably has a niche in the cash paying market, and that's fine. But if she wants to participate in the insurance market, then she needs to participate in what's the well-accepted system across this country that's been developed over a long period of time. And you know, there are other issues in terms of compliance with what we're going to need to do in reporting information under the ACA. There are issues with Medicare, which does require us to use codes. And as Dr. Brown referenced, there's a new coding system coming next year called ICD-10. It'll be very beneficial because it's going to give us a much more detailed look at the kind of care that people are receiving and enable us to engage with members better who have chronic conditions or high-cost conditions and figure out what's going on, how we can partner with providers. But it's a very complex area, and we frankly don't welcome the insurance division entertaining the idea of going back 20 years to a manual processing system.
But to me, it seems it's innovative. We want to cut costs. And the system we have now, our costs are only going higher and higher and higher.
And if I can comment, Senator, yeah. In all respect, while it might look like it's reduced costs on Dr. Brown's chart, it's not a reduced cost ultimately to the payer if we have to handle the claim in a manual way in the way that she suggests. It's a cost shift, not a cost savings in our view.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I know you're the messenger. Okay. Colleagues, I'm not sure what we're going to do with this bill. I mean, I like it. I do. I like it. We have a lot of out-of-network. We have a few out-of-network provider bills. So you're not the first that's trying to deal with this issue. But I appreciate you coming. I think that members will have to talk about it. We need 3 votes to get out of the committee and then 16 on the floor, and I'm not sure we're there. But Senator Roblin will really work the bill. Excuse me. All right. Any other comments? With that, I would close the public hearing on Senate Bill 608, and we're adjourned.